White bread may seem like the plainest of foods, but mass-produced packaged white bread actually has a colorful history. On this week's Please Explain, we're taking a look at how that soft, spongy bread has played an important role in American politics, diet, culture, and food reform movements. Joining us is Aaron Barbara Strain, Associate Professor of Politics at Whitman College in Washington. He's the author of White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf, published by Beacon. And we are also inviting you, our listeners, to join in the conversation. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment or question on our show page at WNYC.org. Hi, Professor. Do I say Barbara Strain, or can I just call you Aaron?
I think Aaron is good. Barbara Strain is a bit of a mouthful.
Do we know when bread first appeared in the human diet?
Well, there seem to be archaeological traces of the making of something like bread. It would have been more of a kind of a crude flat bread made over a heated stone, probably, that go back 30,000 years.
Kind of like pita?
Even cruder than that, I'm guessing. Bread dates back to Paleolithic times by about 10,000-11,000 years ago. People in the ancient Middle East were cultivating wheat, so wheat and barley breads came onto the scene, and then pretty quickly after that, wheat breads co-evolve with the origins of civilizations and empires, and really become the food of civilization and empire in the ancient Middle East, the kind of the cradle of civilization.
And beer at the same time?
Absolutely. Beer and bread have always gone together. They're essentially the same product. One is just a little waterier and uncooked and left to ferment a little bit longer. That's the beer. And you can look even, for example, in the medieval England, for example, on feudal manors, there are estimates that feudal serfs got about 80% of their daily calories from bread, and about the 20% that remained, most of that was probably from beer.
And you point out that the English word lord has bread-related origins.
Right, the English word, the old roots of the word lord come from the phrase bread giver or bread keeper. And for me, that's an important etymology, because it really highlights the fact that bread has always been a political question, and that the person who was the bread keeper, the lord, had both a privilege, the privilege of holding on to bread and distributing it to the serfs, but also the responsibility. And when the bread supply failed, kings and rulers ended up getting their heads chopped off. I mean, if you wonder whether bread is political, just ask Marie Antoinette.
Well, did they all eat the same kind of bread? Doesn't the kind of bread you eat often reveal your place in the social order?
It has, probably from the very beginnings of bread. I mean, there are we can look at ancient Assyria, and bread was divided into various classes of quality, like today, with the kind of more refined, whiter bread at the top of the pyramid and a cruder, browner bread at the bottom of the pyramid. And in those days, it was a very formal system of rationing, where your station in life determined what kind of bread you got in the imperial bread ration.
That seems to have flip-flopped to some degree now. There are a lot of people who would say that white bread represents, a lower status, and dark bread, whole wheats, et cetera, would represent something a little higher.
That's really true. In the United States, really in the past 40 years or so, the title of the chapter where I talk about that is How White Bread Became White Trash. And it's really, the whole book is really thinking about this arc that white bread travels in the United States, from the 19th century, when bread was, as it was in ancient Assyria, a symbol of refinement, of responsible choice, of upper class living, to the present, where it is associated with poor choices, unhealthy living, narrow lives of poverty often.
Although there are many different kinds of white bread. A baguette is white bread, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I have to always clarify that when I'm referring to white bread here, I'm really talking about industrial white bread.
The stuff that is produced and packaged, store-bought white bread, stuff like Wonder Bread.
Right, that is subjected to the kind of the standardized, homogenizing logic of the industrial assembly line, a Fordist a process of producing bread.
And when did these packaged, mass-produced breads first appear in our culture?
It happens amazingly quickly at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And the thing that you have to understand is how significant this would have been for people. In, say, 1900, Americans on average got about 30% of their daily calories from bread. No other single food in the diet contributed as much as bread. It really was the staff of life, the thing that the people relied on more than anything else. And by comparison, nothing today comes even close to providing 30% of our daily calories. So this was very significant. And in 1890, about 90% of bread in the country was home-baked by women. Typically, there were very few small bakeries, usually one oven shops, almost always in large urban areas, often associated with immigrants. Most of the bread was baked at home. But by 1930, this has completely flipped. In 1930, 90% of the bread in the country was baked in factories. Or larger bakeries, factories that were getting increasingly big and increasingly distant from the consumers, and only about 10% was baked at homes, and that was usually in the most rural areas. So there's this dramatic transformation of the most important food in the country.
And was this new white bread marketed as a time and labor-saving convenience for stressed housewives?
It is. In part, although what surprised me as I began to do the research was that that wasn't the central appeal of this bread. And I think that's really where my story begins, with that moment of surprise that, yes, of course, it was a labor-saving device, and this was a moment when women were increasingly going into the workforce, and so that was a very important thing, to be liberated from the relentless responsibility of having to bake that staple food every day was significant, but the real advertising appeal lay in this bread's modernity, that it was this pure, shining product of modern, sparkling factories. And bakers went out of their way to engage with consumers to create this idea that factory bread was a kind of edible utopia. Almost every slice was a promise of a world to come when scarcity and nature could be conquered by technology and progress. Eating this bread was seen as a kind of a way of showing that you are a responsible, modern, forward-looking person.
My guest is Aaron Barbero-Strain, an associate professor of politics at Whitman College in Washington. His book, White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf, is published by Beacon. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Around this time, a lot of white foods were being developed as symbols of purity. We've talked on the show in the past about how vegetable shortenings like Crisco came into being, all part of this idea that you could that white somehow represented a purity that had been unavailable before?
It was, and you have to remember that this moment in history is a moment of great anxiety about food safety. In some ways, much like our present moment, food consumers were very concerned that the country's food system was tainted. And in fact, in many cases, it was. If you think back to Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, his expose of the horrific conditions in meatpacking factories, there was typhus in the milk. And in that moment, which was also a moment when ordinary consumers were just trying to get their minds around the germ theory of disease, there were lots of anxieties and confusions about what purity meant. And very clearly, the color white came to stand in for cleanliness, even though, as many reformers pointed out, that white didn't necessarily mean that the product was clean, but it became a kind of visual spectacle of cleanliness. The bread factories were white, the bakers wore white, the bread was white, and thus you could trust it. Nothing could be hidden. And what's really interesting is that these social anxieties about food safety, these health anxieties about food safety and contamination get wrapped up in more social fears that are roiling through the early 20th century. And this really comes clear in the bread story, because between about 1880 and 1920, middle-class, native-born consumers, particularly in big cities, go through this have a moral panic about bread cleanliness.
Were people getting sick from bread?
Well, here's the thing. You look at the newspaper headlines, and they're yelling, dangerous bakeries menace your health, germs lurk in your bread, is there typhus in your bread? And there's these reports and sanitary inspectors. And so I'm seeing all this, and then I start to do the research, and I can't find any evidence that anyone was actually getting sick from bread. So I'm stuck with that, and so what is going on here? And what I realize as I begin to read the reports on the bread problem is that in that moment, food fears about bread contamination had gotten inseparably bound up with racial anxieties about the new supposedly dirty and diseased Southern and Eastern European immigrants who were coming into cities and touching bread with their hands. Even though most people didn't get their bread from small immigrant bakeries, the immigrant bakery, the small local immigrant bakery that we like to romanticize so much today, became this specter of fear and disease and scariness. And a lot of times in the debates about bread, you realize that people weren't actually debating about whether bread was safe. They were debating about whether America should open its doors to Southern and Eastern European immigrants. And this is something that I see throughout the history of bread, is that our food fears get wrapped up in social fears.
Well, in 1906, we did have the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act. And I'm sure that in some cases that actually was beneficial. But as you point out, maybe not with bread. New York City was where the first major white bread bakeries were created. And I'm assuming that's because we are the major immigrant city.
The major immigrant city, and also in the early 20th century, the city that ate most bread per capita in the country.
Now, was this bread mostly for New York consumption, or was it distributed nationally?
The bread factories around New York would have been for regional distribution, but they were increasingly, by the 1920s, part of national chains that grew into monopolies. Probably the most interesting story that came out of New York is the Ward Baking Company, and it's a story of hubris and financial speculation that would have made Gordon Gekko happy. An industrial baker named William Ward in the 1920s, who was the son of Irish immigrant bakers from the Lower East Side, a family that actually, one of the very few immigrant bakery families that made good. They started off with a bakery on the Lower East Side that baked probably about 200 loaves of bread a day, and by 1910 had factories in New York that were producing upwards of 500,000 loaves a day. And what he decides to do is he wants to corner the entire bread market in the United States. It was this incredible gambit for power. Imagine the power it would have given him if he had been able to literally monopolize the bread supply, this most important food throughout the country.
And Ward Bakery becomes Wonder Bakery?
Eventually it does. So he starts to unfold this scheme using money leverage from stock speculators and good old-fashioned thuggery, and slowly assembles more and more major baking companies into smaller and smaller baking companies. And in 1925, he's very close to creating this corner on the American bread supply. And then unions and social reformers and ultimately government regulators step in and stop his attempt. And it's a big scandal. And he dies a few years later, quite young, in disgrace. But possibly in order to distance his company's name from the scandalous taint of the Ward family, he takes on the name of one of the many baking companies that he had acquired during his acquisition spree, and that was the Wonder Bakers.
Now, was his pretty much the same product and taste and texture that we now think of as Wonder Bread?
You know, I struggled with trying to figure out how we can. You know, we don't have any. As much as industrial white bread has a long shelf life, we don't have any from that era that have stuck around. So I've never been able to really fully grasp how different or similar it was. But the sense I get talking to various kinds of industrial bakers is that it is fairly similar what they were looking at. Although in the 1950s, bread goes through another moment where it gets even whiter, even fluffier, even sweeter.
We have a caller who has a question along these lines. Francis from Queens, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I'd like to know, before the introduction of white bread, on average, what was the shelf life of similar types of bread?
Well, I mean, imagine it was similar to what you'd look at with homemade bread today. It tends to have a shelf life where it's really quite fresh for a day, and then you know it's still palatable and edible for a while after that. But it gets unpalatable fairly quickly.
So, what were some of the technological and industrial advances that made this mass-produced factory-made bread possible and gave it the kind of shelf life it has? Because it can sit on the shelf for weeks, I think.
Absolutely. And bread industrializes later than some other major important foods of that early 20th century, in part because it was difficult to industrialize it, because bread is this living, breathing, growing organic product, right? It's a relationship between a baker, flour, water, and living microorganisms. And so how do you, the problem bakers faced was, how do you tame this living organism to the standardized, relentless, speedy pace of a capitalist industrial assembly line? Imagine, you know, how it would have vexed Henry Ford if, every time the temperature changed in the factory, his Model T parts shrank or grew, or if there was a gust of wind in his factory, his Model T parts would collapse. This is the challenge of trying to industrialize bread baking. So all of the bakery engineering and the baking chemistry that goes into creating this moment in the early 20th century is really aimed at overcoming the natural obstacle of how you tame bread to the assembly line. So basically what they were looking for were three holy grails. They needed dough that was faster, higher, and stronger. Faster was probably the most important, because if you think about it, dough just sitting around taking up space on the factory floor doing nothing, quote-unquote nothing, what we bakers like to call fermentation, where it's actually developing its flavor and rising. But from a business perspective, that's just dough sitting around doing nothing, taking up space, right? That's anathema to the relentless, continual, fast pace of an assembly line. So everything, the first step of baking technology and engineering was to make dough work faster. So the mixing is speeded up. Industrial baking is mixed at much higher speeds than in artisanal bread. It's fermented at much higher temperatures and humidity than artisanal bread. If you get a nice loaf of an artisanal baguette at one of those wonderful bakeries you have in New York, that has most likely been fermented in very slowly in a cool environment. Industrial bread is fermented very quickly in a hot, humid environment. And then it's given a series of chemical stimulants called yeast foods that are often different kinds of mineral salts and enzymes that, oddly enough, are also sometimes used in things like fertilizer, flame retardant, and bomb making. But these additives then are kind of like meth for microbes. And they speed those microbes up so that the bread can grow faster and faster and faster and can be moved through the assembly line in a quicker pace. That's the big innovation, is making dough work faster. Other innovations are trying to get the bread to rise higher because by the 1920s, customers start wanting fluffy bread. And the story of why they start wanting fluffy bread is actually an interesting, it's a very telling story about bread industrialization.
Can we wait for you to tell that?
Absolutely.
Because I have to go to a little break. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about how you slice this spongy stuff and take some listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. My guest is Aaron Barbero-Strain, Associate Professor of Politics at Whitman College in Washington. We're speaking to him from Walla Walla, Washington. And his book, White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf, is published by Beacon. And we are back with Aaron Barbero-Strain. His book, White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf, published by Beacon. And we've been getting your calls in at 212-433-9692. Let's take one of those calls. John from Paramus, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing? I just wanted to know, I think you answered my question. You don't think you could make this Wonder Bread type at home, right? This is just an industrial thing. The average baker, my mother used to bake bread all the time, but it was always nice, hard, crusty Italian bread. Do you think an average person, a person who baked, could make this type of bread at home?
John, that's a great question. And, you know, I actually set out to try to do that. I set out to try to reproduce the iconic loaf of 1950s Wonder Bread at home using home baking equipment, and it actually worked. It wasn't easy, it wasn't perfect, but I had help. And that's in the mid-1950s, the USDA sponsored what I ended up calling the Manhattan Project of Bread. It was this multi-year, multi-city, multi-method attempt to gain a panoramic understanding of how Americans ate bread, when they ate bread, what kind of bread they ate, and then use that information to engineer the perfect loaf of white bread. And they left a report of that. And so I was able to use that and recreate it. Again, the key things in that were using a series of chemicals and baking techniques to make the dough rise really quickly and really high. And then the last part was that the dough had to be incredibly strong. Because if you take a delicate artisanal loaf, a baguette loaf or a pain au levain, and subject it to the high-speed mixing and the high heat and the rapid fermentation of an industrial process, it'll just collapse. So they needed a series of chemical additives in order to strengthen the dough. But you can actually get a hold of those chemicals, and you can make your own Wonder Bread at home. I wrote a piece in the magazine called The Believer that has a recipe that you can follow if you'd like to try it at home.
It has a lot of soy-based products in it. We have a clip from a commercial for Wonder Bread from the past. Maybe we can listen to it.
Because Wonder Soft Whipped Bread is made from batter, not dough. It has no holes. Get Wonder Soft Whipped.
Now, why are they bragging that it's made with batter, not dough, and has no holes? I understand why it has no holes, because they've sped up the fermentation process. But are they suggesting that it's more like cake than bread?
I think that was the idea behind that particular ad series. And the no holes was also a result not just of the batter so much as the use of emulsifiers that help. They're chemicals that help fats and water mix together. That gives you a much more uniform crust. But the whole idea that bread is being sold as this perfectly homogeneous, perfectly smooth, essentially an industrial artifact, not an artisanal artifact, is really part of that modernist aesthetic that grows up in the 1920s. In the 1920s, baking engineers literally re-engineered the look of bread to be streamlined, like the Zephyr train or the kind of the sleek, streamlined aesthetic of the 20s. They wanted to make bread look like a work of modern art.
And they sold them as Pullman loaves in some cases. Robert, one of our listeners, left this comment. He remembers Bond, Silver Cup, Wonder as the big three white bread companies. They were all in New York. Did they all pretty much use the same kind of recipe?
Yeah, white bread, industrial white bread, was pretty much an indistinguishable item. And that was the big challenge that bread, industrial bread advertisers always faced, was how do you get people to have some loyalty to this product that, you know, essentially tastes the same from whomever you buy it from. And that's where appeals to naturalness appears to being homemade, or also the appeals to safety and strength. The thing that really, during the 1930s, actually, white bread, industrial white bread consumption begins to fall. At the end of the 1920s, a series of critics had emerged who were calling industrial bread a weak staff of life, and talking about how industrial white bread was making America fat, dumb, and weak. Much like we hear today, there were these critics out there, and it was starting to have an impact by the 1930s. And the thing that really saves Wonder Bread and white bread and industrial white bread in general is the wartime enrichment of bread with vitamins that takes place during World War II, first as a mandatory thing and then later as a major selling point. And we see in the 1950s that the selling point that bread companies used was, this is a strong bread. This bread will give your children strength. It will improve their mental capacities. It will make them able to compete on the sports field and succeed in school.
And Americans were also reading about long bread lines in the Soviet Union. So this was a kind of the Cold War was reflected in our choice of this bread? Or was it simply that kids preferred Wonder Bread for peanut butter and jelly and grilled cheese sandwiches?
You know, there's always an element of that preference there. But in terms of why it takes on such an important cultural meaning at that moment, the Cold War actually does play into it a bit. First of all, during World War II, there was a massive educational campaign undertaken on the part of the government, war planners in the government, as well as private sector bakers, to essentially train Americans to associate vitamin-enriched bread with strength, patriotism, and fighting ability. There was this strong idea cultivated that in fact the Surgeon General said eating enriched white bread is every American's patriotic duty.
That was
huge for bakers. To have your food called a patriotic duty, and after the war they wanted to continue that association, keep that idea alive. And so they did that by associating it with children's strength and children's competitive abilities.
Richard on the Upper West Side writes, I recall one day in the 50s when my grandmother, who was born in 1878 and should have known better, proudly demonstrated how Wonder Bread was pure white compared to the other baker's breads. So it was better. Now, what is it about white flour? Most white flour is bleached, although we do have unbleached white flour. Why do we bother making flour white? Aren't we taking all sorts of nutrients out of it when we do that?
Oh, absolutely. Which is why bread then needs to be enriched with those synthetic vitamins and minerals. You know, and this dates back millennia. People were making white bread flours in ancient Athens. So this is something that has gone on for a long time. It's been associated with purity. From an industrial standpoint, in the present, bakers like white bread or white flour because it lasts longer. Whole wheat flour tends to go rancid quicker. Whole wheat flour is also harder to turn into that super light, super fluffy product that consumers came to like in the 1920s. So there are some industrial reasons, some business reasons why white flour is promoted these days. But there's also this kind of ancient association of white soft flour with elite status.
Now, Hugh left this message on our show page. He said food problems weren't isolated to the United States. In France, 200 years ago, there were cases of bakers adding sawdust to flour. And we've also heard about borax and chalk being put in flour. So there must have been real concerns about the purity of the bread, even if it didn't make people sick.
Absolutely. I mean, we romanticize the small local baker today, but in many ways, that you know, they were pushed by competition to enhance their product however they could. Borax, chalk, alum, all kinds of whitening agents were used, as well as you know, working immigrant workers nearly to death. The average work day for an immigrant baker in New York in the 1910s was about 15 to 16 hours a day, plus 24-hour shifts on Saturdays. So this was a brutal, grim business. So there were concerns. The concerns were primarily, I think, concerns for worker health and safety.
Aaron, we have just less than a minute left. I just have to address one other thing. There's
sure.
That saying, the best thing since sliced bread. Was slicing bread in this case rather difficult because it's so spongy?
It was difficult because bread engineers had created bread that was so soft. If you tried to cut it with your kitchen knife, it would just make a huge mess.
So they came up with some kind of industrial slicing method, I'd imagine. This is one of the things you address in this book, the book called White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. It is published by Beacon and written by our guest, Aaron Barbara Strain, Associate Professor of Politics at Whitman College in Washington. Thank you so much for participating in today's Please Explain segment.
Great. Thanks for having me.
On Monday's Labor Day show, Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz explains why he thinks the growing gap between the wealthiest Americans and the rest of us is bad for our economy and for our democracy. Also, political strategist James Carville and pollster Stan Greenberg on how Washington and Wall Street have made life difficult for average Americans. Then, Tana Colby on why most black and white Americans tend to self-segregate. And Andy Berwitz shares his thoughts on the presidential campaign so far. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Higgins, the executive producer. We had help today from Lindsay Hodges and Sarah Waltuck. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we will see you on Monday.